The Daily. Dave Hodgson.
Hey, Dave.
Heading over now to Finland to speak to Mark Alwyn Thomas on his book Blades of Grass. And looking forward to this one, I certainly am. Good afternoon, Mark. How are you?
Good afternoon, Dave. I'm good. Thank you very much.
There you are in Finland. Were you born and raised in the United Kingdom? Is that right?
That's right. And moved to Finland in 1974.
That's why you've got such a good English accent still then.
Well, yeah.
Are you still quite British in your way of life, culture, or more Finnish now?
Well, kind of a nice mixture.
Yeah. This is fantastic because I'm talking about somebody I've not come across before, George Alwyn Hogg. First of all, before we go into who he was and what the book is about, your relationship with him.
He was my mother's youngest brother, so my uncle.
Yep.
And, yeah.
But you, so, you were in a different time period.
I never knew him. Yeah. I was born 6 months after he tragically died at the age of 30 in China.
So where did you first hear about him? Where did you get turned on to what he did?
Well, I of course, his memories have always been in the background, to some extent. But as you can imagine, when I was small, the tragedy of his death, quickly followed by the death of his father, it was a painful memory. Yeah. For a long time, so not a lot was said in a way, but I got to get really deep into it, into his story, when in 1988, to this memorial in China, I went there to represent his family. This was a memorial for quite a famous, very long time foreign friend of China, a New Zealander by the name of Rui Ali. And my uncle was a close colleague of Rui Ali.
Right.
Setting up a cooperative system during the war-torn years in China.
And so this is kind of, was this kind of refreshing you a little bit of some of the stuff that you've already heard, or were you starting to hear new stories about him?
Well, yeah. As I say, I went to China to take part in these memorial events, which were just astounding, very high profile. The memory of these two people are held in very high regard, even today, in China.
Yeah.
And as this whole week of events unfolded, I was more and more noticed that my uncle's name and kept coming up, and with a certain degree of reverence, as it were. And I was gobsmacked. Then when I returned to England and sort of reporting all this to my aunt, who's the next oldest in this large family of five children, my mother was the eldest daughter of, she then passed on to me two caseloads of my uncle's letters and manuscripts of articles he'd written during those years. And I started putting this together, largely using his own words, because he was a very colourful writer.
Yeah.
He was an extremely good writer. So I've used a lot of his own words in this book. And it's, as my publisher said, it's very close to being an autobiography.
Yeah, because of the amount of content that... Before we get on to some of that, I wanted just to... Because there'll be people listening saying, well, who is he? Who was he? What did he do? It was British... I suppose described as a British adventurer was George Alwyn Hogg. And what made him go to China in the first place?
Well, he had newly graduated from Oxford, from Wadham College in Oxford, after studying what's known nowadays as PPE, and his
which is
arm,
sorry, PPE. What's that? Sorry.
PPE, which is politics, philosophy, right. and economics.
Okay.
And his aunt, his mother's elder sister, was about to launch on yet another of her world lecturing trips, her tours, lecturing on pacifism. Now, this is the 1930s.
Yeah.
Okay. Erwin, my uncle Erwin, had a chance to accompany her, and he set out first of all to America, and then they went to Japan, and then on to Shanghai, and he was captured by what was going on in China, and he'd promised to pacifist friends in Japan to find out what was really happening in China, because the kind of news was coming trickling back into Japan what was really happening, but the Japanese were very, very they were drummed by propaganda saying Japan is doing wonderful things in China, and of course it was quite the opposite. So he wanted to stay in China. He got a job as a journalist with one of the American press agencies, and then he had kind of great freedom to travel, observe, and write. And he kind of just got stuck into it. And he was one of the first, well, he was the first journalist to go and interview the newly set up Chinese industrial cooperatives, the main guy in setting this up, with the blessings of the then government, the Kuomintang, the nationalist government, was this Rui Ali, this New Zealander, and he was caught by the idea during this interview of what this organization was being set up to do. And then later, to cut lots of long stories short, because he had so many adventures, he then joined the cooperative movement as a publicity man. So he was traveling around, checking out the cooperatives, helping set things up. But then his main job was to write articles which were published in the USA, and to raise funds. And big money was being sent from the USA, from Canada, to a certain extent from Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and so on. And then they realized that they've got to think of how this is going to continue in the future, training up youngsters to be familiar with Western culture, the English language, technologies, and so on. So my uncle was asked to set up one of the schools there, which was the only school that survived through corruption of the nationalist government and so on. The others seemed to fail.
Okay. I should imagine then that at that point, there's not many Westerners. You mentioned New Zealand guy, but there's not many Westerners in China at that point.
Well, there were a surprising number that he came across, and quite a number of these were guys who had come to China. They're Quakers. They were members of the Friends Ambulance Unit, which did a convoy of medical supplies from Burma, along the Burma Road, into China and up into the Northwest. And a lot of these guys were all caught up with the whole idea of being of some kind of help in whatever they could do. And quite a lot of these fellows that he came across and they worked with him, or they were doing other things in education and engineering and all kinds of stuff. There were a surprising number of Westerners in there. There were missionaries that he came across.
Did he consider himself to be a missionary? I mean, what was his... Was he a man of faith, or
he had a nonconformist upbringing, with a very much a pacifist influence in the family, and he also had quite an international education, in that before going to, as you might call it, high school in Britain, he went to an international school in Switzerland for a year,
yeah,
at an early age. So he had a very sort of international feeling in a way, and then his pacifism and so on, and then the sort of education he had at in Britain in at school and in at university and so on. He was a real all-rounder and a sort of humanist. Wasn't so much religious,
right?
But he was kind of a believer in people,
yeah,
and you know, a believer in a power, you know, that somehow guides everything. So,
but he had a sure sense of right and wrong and injustice.
Yeah, sure.
And,
oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And he was described in after he passed away. He was described by the then Bishop of Hong Kong. Was it Bishop Roots? As a new kind of missionary. In other words, not a Bible-punching missionary,
yeah,
but a person who lived and mixed and understood the local people and got down and, you know, did positive things.
Yeah, I was reading about him earlier, because my background is I'm a pastor of a church, and so I've got that... So yeah. I've got a little bit of knowledge of missionaries that have gone to China over the years. And when you talked about the fact that he really immersed himself in the culture and the life of the Chinese people at that time, I couldn't help but think of Hudson Taylor, the missionary that went to China many years ago, and the way in which he kind of embraced the Chinese culture in that way. And so he wasn't somebody trying to take a westernized way of doing things. Yeah. He was actually wanting to be part of those Chinese
people.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. That's where so many missionaries have gone wrong, to imposed Western ways,
yeah,
in areas where it just doesn't suit. Yeah.
What I find quite fascinating, as we talk about him, and we've been discussing him for the last 15 minutes, what's quite amazing is that he died at the age of 30. I mean, anybody listening, yeah, to this interview would assume that he lived to an old age when you talk about the, yeah, amount that he actually did in his life.
Absolutely phenomenal amount that he did. He spent 8 years in China, and he achieved far more than many people do in a whole lifetime. And, you know, on top of that, he's remembered in China particularly for, you know, saving all these 60 odd pupils and taking them on a long trek into the northwest along the Silk Road for a while to reestablish the school, taking them out of the danger of the encroaching Japanese, and also the nationalists, the Kuomintang, were wanting to just destroy the school and recruit all these lads into the Kuomintang army, which was really failing at the time. He's very much remembered particularly for that. That's the sort of kind of highlight. But he did so much more. and this story of saving the kids. It's like thinking of Gladys Aylward. Do you remember the story?
Yes, yes.
Inn of the Sixth Happiness, and so on. It's a kind of a flavors of that. A film came out in 2008. Roger Spottiswood directed it, Children of Huan Shi, it was called, which was portraying this story. It was a Hollywood treatment. Well, we know what that is. But the main thing was that, the most important thing was that the news came out. The word was spread, as it were, that there was a guy of this name at that time in China doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
There was so much fabrication in the story of the film, but the crux of the matter was there.
Amazing, absolutely.
So I've wanted to sort of really put all the records straight with very much my uncle's own words and the sort of authority in a way by using his own words, his own experiences.
Yeah. And the fact that I think that you've actually gone to such detail and like you say, it's almost like an autobiography. You know, the amount of his content that's in there, I think that's just going to be almost like for not making it sound too kind of gruesome, but a message from beyond the grave in many ways. Just a reminder, we're running right out of time here, but we could talk about legacy, and we could talk about so many other things, but if anybody wants to get the book, you can, of course. It's called Blades of Grass. It's by Mark Alwyn Jones. It's available on talkradioeurope.com if you click on our Mark Alwyn Thomas. Did I say Jones? All right.
Yes.
It's available on Talk Radio Europe as well. If you go onto our bookshop banner, you can order it there as well. Mark, we could be chatting all afternoon. There's so much, and again, which amazes me, is the fact that, and it puts us to shame, really, the amount he did in his lifetime.
Yeah, it is truly inspirational.
Mark, thank you for coming on and sharing a little bit of the story. I'm sure there'll be lots of people wanting to buy more and finding out exactly just the impact he had and why China, even to this day, there's a legacy there from him. Mark, thank you for your time this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Dave.
Lovely.
Thank you.
God bless. Bye-bye. Yes.
This is Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.